Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. The mission of the Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voices radio show, where reasonable voices in the arts and politics and history and education get to share their points of view with us. My guest today is an award-winning documentary filmmaker, photographer, and published author. He was born in Cordoba, Argentina, but now he lives in Charlottesville, Virginia. And in Charlottesville, he develops and produces documentaries at the University of Virginia. His unique on-camera work has been acknowledged both in domestic as well as international festivals. And so, Eduardo Montes Bradley, I welcome you to the Reasonable Voices. It's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Eduardo, how are you today? Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here. Thank you very much.
I remember the, our paths have crossed at least twice, and it seems our professional and personal passions for film and politics and history have a lot in common. So, and of course, I want to talk to you about the Monroe Hill, your documentary that will be shown at the Virginia Film Festival 2015. But let's first give our listeners some of our backstory. I met you the first time at the symposium of the universities confronting the legacy of slavery. That was back in October of 2014 in Charlottesville on grounds at University of Virginia. And so let's begin with Unearthed and Understood. Unearthed and Understood. Yes. Talk to us about that.
That was a very interesting experience to me because it was a commission which I was not a member of. I was called upon to document the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting because it was mostly like a journalistic work, which you go and you sort of swim through the different arguments and come up with a portrait,
mm-hmm.
a polyphonic portrait of many voices, trying to show what the present situation of the commission is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what the documentary does. And it's very difficult not to get involved, emotionally involved. And,
yes.
I wouldn't say emotionally, I would say ideologically involved.
Yes. Well, it was quite an event, and your documentary was well received, yes?
Yeah, I believe so, yes. And by the members of the commission and by other universities that are going or undergoing STEM experience.
Yes. And now another, shall I say, thing we have in common, I think. I was once almost had Julian Bond on the show. It never did work out between his schedule and mine, but he always responded, I thought, so graciously, via email with trying to work things out. And, of course, we've recently lost him, a great human being. But you have also
done a Reflections from the Front Lines of the Civil Rights Movement that is about Julian Bond?
Yeah, it is about Julian Bond, and it is about the relationship between the black movement in America and that period of time that he was a protagonist.
Yes.
I like to think of that documentary sometimes as a selfish experiment in which I was trying to learn.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't trying to expose. I was not trying to show what I knew.
Uh-huh.
I was trying to understand what happened. And I think that why that is what makes the film so candid, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that's the best part of the film. The what I wish I would have had at the time, and Julian told me later that he felt the same way, is that we would have had more time.
Hmm.
And Julian did not necessarily understand when we started the way that I went, which is many hours, many days, exchanging different sections from different interviews.
Yes.
To try to make it more compelling.
Yes.
And to avoid having the film becoming a talking head interview for CNN.
Yes.
We did what I did what I could, and I think we graciously avoided having one of those talking head programs at the end.
Yes.
By inserting nearly 550 cuts to that half an hour documentary, which is a lot of cuts.
Wow. Yes.
Of archival footage mostly.
Mm-hmm.
But it was all done in one interview, one session.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a challenge.
Yeah, I think it was. And I wish, that's why I say, and I told him, I wish we had more time.
Yes.
And he told me, well, should I have known what I know now about you, we would have had probably more opportunities to talk, but we didn't.
Yeah.
Well, we did, in fact, after the film was made, because we remain in contact and in a very, very friendly terms.
Very good.
We spent many evenings together here and in Washington. But unfortunately, all that is no more, right?
Yes, it was quite a loss. I mean, he wasn't that old, and well, it's just. But he was an activist to the very end. That's for certain.
Yes.
You know, I have to say, I know you acknowledged, I mean, we all have moments in our lives where suddenly we think we know where we're headed and what we want to do, and something touches us or turns us around or whatever. And we journalists always try to put a label on something, but for lack of a better label, a turning point. I have to say that... I was young during the 60s assassinations. They certainly made a strong impact on... We're just getting a little interference. So
yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you now. I was just talking about a turning point for me, even though I was young, but still, the impact of the assassinations of the 1960s. Especially perhaps the, well, I don't know that I can say one impacted more than the other. They just seemed to keep happening. And Bobby Kennedy's assassination was upsetting because it seemed to indicate that they were going to continue. People were going to continue to be assassinated for their political points of view. In any case, what happened to me is that I sort of turned away for a long time from my love of history and politics, and I got immersed instead in opera and theater direction, and then when I was in New York acting on soap operas and developing new scripts of unknown writers. That's what I love. But I understand just a few years later, not far behind me, in 1973, you experienced a turning point that also related to deaths, including those of Pablo Picasso and Pablo Casals.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but how did that affect you? You turned to writing and directing. Tell us about yourself, as they say.
It's interesting because when the death of the assassinations of Luther King and the Kennedys were happening to me within the rationale of the time and the place where I was living, I was in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Well, it seemed like a very high price to pay politics, but it was part of the political game. It's something that I thought it was plausible. It was admissible in a sense, if you were in political game, because that's what happened in those days.
Yes,
all over Europe and all over Latin America.
Yes,
they were dying in the streets.
Yes.
So I didn't think that there was anything. In fact, I would probably ask myself, well, why is it everybody is so concerned about the death of one individual when this happens all the time?
Yes.
But when the death of Pablo Picasso, Pablo Neruda, and Pablo Casals, the three are called Pablos, which is not a very frequent name, but one is the greatest celloist of all time.
Yes.
The other one is the man who revolutionized the Beaux-Arts, you know, the universe of color and form.
Yes.
And the other one was the Nobel Prize of Poetry, of Literature, and a great poet. So I go like, well, they were not predestined to die. They were supposed to be, in a sense, immortal. So there was a very poetic grasp on these three deaths at a time in which we were walking on the onset of a revolution, which was the uprising in Latin America in 1970.
It just seems it was a period. Well, of course, there's so many people now that are born who weren't living then and know nothing of it, and history doesn't get taught in a way that makes us see that what is past is prologue unless we change something. But the 60s and the 70s really were, we think of the 60s because of all the bloodshed, and as you say, it was really our entire hemisphere. This part of the world was going through this turmoil, and artists everyday citizens walking around on the street. I mean, even now we, of course, get upset with the shootings in public places. But as the president keeps reminding us, it's not that we should feel any less concern. But, you know, people get shot in this country every day, all over, everywhere. So it hurts when it's a... You know, when you're close to it, either politically, historically, or artistically, or family, and friend, or whatever. What do you think, for instance, the people on Roseburg responding to Obama's visit, who were so upset about his potential move to limit gun ownership, and in the same town picketing against him for that, where these kids were killed? How do you... As a filmmaker, as a human being, how do you make sense out of that, I guess, is my question.
I don't think there's a way of making sense out of it. I do have a very hard time understanding both postures. I have a hard time understanding the Second Amendment, and I have a hard time trying to understand those who want to get rid of the Second Amendment. Because the argument is sort of locked between the progressives and the conservative, and way away from the rational thinking. And when I was growing up in Argentina or in Europe, gun ownership was out of the question. You could not own a gun, and people were dying left and right.
Yes,
so. Having the exclusive ownership of guns in the hands of the state and the security forces, to me, doesn't necessarily mean that less people are going to die.
Exactly.
So I don't know if it's a question that I have an answer for. I don't know exactly where to stand. I think it's terrible. I think there's nothing really new. Maybe the numbers are greater. For example, right now I see that all this concern with international terrorism, right?
Yes.
But you and I grew up at a time where the red brigades in Italy had Italy upside down.
Yes.
And the Red Army in Germany had Germany upside down. The IRA in Ireland had Great Britain upside down. And the independentist desk in Spain had Europe upside down.
Yes.
So terrorism to me is nothing new.
Well, I agree with that. I think I do think, and I don't mean to trivialize it because it isn't as simple as this, but certainly communication and the media and technology has put it in our face a great deal more. But I agree with you. I think it's always been there. And for that matter, state-sponsored terrorism, as you're pointing out, as you experienced in your country before moving and becoming an American citizen, but people, governments can be, you know, the people who talk about guns or say who want to keep them. And I grew up in a family with guns, lots of guns. But the people who want to keep them keep saying, well, if we take away the guns, only the criminals will have guns, which I think is really an oversimplification. But the reality is, I don't want to reach a point where only law enforcement has guns. I think that's just as dangerous. Or the military are the only ones with the guns. So it's a tough fence to walk, I guess.
What about why don't we start, for example, I think that there is a steps that can be taken in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you need a driver's license to drive a car, why wouldn't you need a gun license to own a gun?
Yes.
So that sort of thing, I believe, would be steps in the right direction to try to normalize the situation. It's just taking 350 million guns out of the streets, you know, is practically impossible. How are you going to do that?
Exactly.
You can't disarm the United States of America. You just basically can't. So you should start somewhere else. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for a failure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So perhaps a limiting, regulating it would be a good way to start.
Yes, at least some kind of more extensive background checks, which I know a lot of people are pushing, some waiting time before you get the... I mean, these don't, to me, don't seem to be an unreasonable thing. And again, I grew up with uncles who, had not only been in World War II, but had handguns and knew how to use them and did so when they felt it was necessary. But that's another show, I guess. I just...
If you want to purchase anything of value, let's say a car or whatever it is that you want to purchase, even to join a club, might pull your credit record.
Yes.
And it shows that you're not in a position to move forward with what you had in mind.
Yes.
Well, maybe the same thing should take place with a gun. You go buy a gun and they pull out a record and says, I'm sorry, you're not getting one. And if you ever get caught with one, you're going to go to jail.
Yes. Yes. It's common sense is what it is. It's just common sense. Well, I didn't ask Eduardo on the show so we could talk about gun violence, but it is something of great, obviously, interest to everyone, regardless of what your point of view. And I just think we all need to be looking for reasonable solutions and not just fighting about the gun itself. But we're going to take a break now. My guest today is Eduardo Montes Bradley, who is a documentarian writer and... Well, we'll be right back. You stay with us. Don't go away.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute.
In 1969, we were smack in the center of great change. The youth of America was turning on and tuning out to the great consternation of the establishment. And two hippies, Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda, produced Easy Rider, a low-budget film that tapped into the heartbeat of its time and became a box office sensation. Following their success in a cross-border drug deal, Captain America, Peter Fonda, and Billy, Dennis Hopper, embarked upon a cross-country road trip on their tricked-out motorcycles. They wanted to find America. Along the way, their counterculture presence either clashed with the establishment or resulted in warm embrace, thus colorfully illustrating the essential conflict of the times. Easy Rider is an iconic film, a must-see for all film lovers. It made a star of Jack Nicholson, playing a small-town attorney who tosses it all to join the rebels, was the first film to integrate the classic music of its time, magically capturing essential mood, and, by intent or psychedelically induced luck, it spoke profound truths to a confused nation. Nearing the end of their journey, Captain America turns to Billy and utters, "We blew it, man." Speaking for a generation, could he have been any more right? Easy Rider. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices radio talk show. My guest today is film director Eduardo Montes Bradley, and we've been talking about his work, but also about politics and gun violence and international history. But we want to switch now, getting back to the University of Virginia, where Eduardo is now working. We've talked about some of the work he's done there recently, but like to shift now to his documentary, Monroe Hill, which is going to be featured at the Virginia Film Festival this year in November 2015, coming up very soon. Most of us think the Rotunda and other buildings on grounds at the University of Virginia are the oldest buildings, but in reality, they are not. Monroe Hill was, I believe, the first home of President James Monroe, and it is on the grounds at the University of Virginia. But let's let Eduardo tell us about it. It's called the Cradle of the University of Virginia. Yes, tell us about that and the making of the film.
We decided to give a second title to Monroe Hill, the film, and we call it Monroe Hill, the Cradle of the University of Virginia.
Uh-huh.
After a long conversation with architect Richard Guy Wilson, and who, in a conversation on camera, basically, he said that there were other tracks available that Jefferson could have picked, like the road, you know, this 40 acres that he purchased were not the only ones.
Mm-hmm.
The only land for sale at the time. But one of the things that made this tract of land more attractive was the fact that there were buildings already there.
Mm-hmm.
And these buildings were the buildings of James Monroe's farm in Albemarle. So in a sense, you can even conclude after watching the film, at least I can conclude after working on the research and the film, that the university is what it is because the farm was what it was.
Ah, yes.
So that is one point of interest. There are more. For example, common belief leads you to think that James Monroe sold the farm to the Board of Visitors or to the University of Virginia. And that is not that accurate. In fact, it's exactly the opposite, because James Monroe was a member of the Board of Visitors. So how could you be in the selling and the end and the buying end of the bargain unless the deal is taking someplace in Guerrero, Mexico, right?
Yeah.
What happened here is that Monroe had sold that property long the university purchased it. He was as surprised that we are now to find out when he was told that the land that the commission was buying to establish the University of Virginia was in his former plantation, or part of his former plantation. In fact, the part of his former plantation where his dwellings were, where his home was.
Just,
so I think that is interesting, and it changes the equation, changes a little bit the way that we look at this.
It does. You know, most of us Well, actually, most of us don't know very much about James Monroe. You know, we hear about Dolly Madison all the time because of what took place. But James Monroe was the fifth president of the United States between Madison and John Quincy Adams. And Monroe Hill currently is the house itself, or what was the house, currently houses the administrative offices of Brown Residential College, which is located on the grounds of the university, of course. But tell us, you're involving the students in this, in the documentary, and of course, architecture and the history is as important to this film as is the art of film itself. So how did that work for you? How working with the students and the different interdepartmental cooperation and the discoveries? But start wherever you like. I know I've got a hundred questions about it.
I have myself a lot of questions and not enough conclusions about the experience.
Mm-hmm.
Being that perhaps the most interesting part was the interdisciplinary, which is not something that the university seems to be acquainted with,
mm-hmm.
or is not being practiced that often. And that's one of the things of the film, that the film brings people from archaeology,
yes.
From history, from architectural history, archaeological architecture, you know, from different branches of knowledge and science,
yes.
and humanities, and that needs a space for thinking, for reasoning, that is not necessarily copy-shaping ground.
Mm.
So I think that the students were thrilled because of that, and like in everything else, you get a slice of, let's say, 20, 25 students, and you're going to have 10 that are extremely interested, 5 that are definitely committed,
mm-hmm.
and 2 that are outrageously committed to the project.
Mm.
And one of those, and I would like to mention it, was a young man, Kurt Hilberger,
mm-hmm.
who unfortunately died a week ago in a car accident.
Oh, no.
And the film is dedicated to him.
Hmm. Oh, I didn't know that either. Gee.
Yes.
Well, it's just, it's the old thing, you know, we don't know how much time we have, so the thing to do is to do the most you can with the time you have. I think that's the...
He did quite a lot. He
yes.
was the most committed student to the project.
Excellent. What can you tell us some of the other discoveries? There were names found in the wall, in the water?
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful thing, anecdote. But it's not on the film, because that occurred in the mid-19th century, which is the students that were going to Monroe Hill left their signatures between the bricks on the eastern wall of one of the colonnades. And there's several things, because there are people that went on to be very prominent men in society, like the president of the University of North Carolina or the Surgeon General of the United States. We found those signatures there, and that was interesting. But that is not necessarily the film, because the film starts with the time that James Monroe moves to Albemarle County and settles in Monroe Hill, and ends with the consecration of the cornerstone of Pavilion 7. So the film ends in 1817.
I see. Uh-huh.
Perhaps the most important or most relevant contribution of the film is to put that building on the map. Because
yes.
if you look at the official history of James Monroe in the United States and the official history of the University of Virginia, James Monroe seems to have moved directly from Fredericksburg in 1789 to Highland,
yes.
There is no mention almost to Monroe Hill.
That's true. That's very true. I mean, everyone knows
so
about
I hope with this film to have at least clarified that this was an entire decade. And it's the first decade in the history of this country. And it's a very rich decade. And that this film played a prominent role. And it's a good space to study that period.
Mm. How did you get, well, of course, I know Jody Kibasa and his position at University of Virginia, so this may be too obvious a question, but When did Jody and you get together so that Monroe Hill is going to be a part of the Virginia Film Festival this year? How did that come about?
We sort of knew it all along because Jody was part of the initial conversations, the first thing that we did. When we had this project in mind, was to run it by him to see what he thought about a movie about James Monroe and about this building. And he was very enthusiastic about it.
Yes, I can imagine.
So the film had to be really bad for him not to want to program it. And I believe that he likes it, and that's why the film is at the festival this year, November 6th.
Excellent. And the film festival runs, I believe it's November 5th through the 8th. Yes. And it is in Charlottesville, Virginia, several venues. We invite everyone to come. And one of the things, and one of the great works that you will see is Monroe Hill. I like the fact always when different departments can work together and students can be involved, not just in a classroom or with a textbook, but whatever they are studying, they can actually be in a hands-on situation. So I love that about the making of this documentary, because my experience at Juilliard and at Catholic University, the two things I loved the most outside of politics and history were music and theater. And yet those departments, when I would even suggest as a student at Catholic University and then as a administrator with the American Opera Center, that they just could not grasp that concept of why don't we do something together, you know, not all the time, but once a year. So how do you find the students and the administration at University of Virginia more willing to cohabitate on projects?
It's very interesting. This project did not come from the administration of the University of Virginia. Uh-huh. This was my initiative with Brown College.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But it was granted an award from the Jefferson Trust.
Yes.
Which is the Pennsylvania Alumni Association.
Mm-hmm.
And they made it very clear that one of the main concerns was the participation of the student.
Mm-hmm.
So it is important that when an award is granted, that the conditions clearly establish that the participation of the students is a requirement.
It's such a...
Perhaps that's what that could be the game changer. That's what the Jefferson Trust is doing, and that is good.
It is good. How do you work as a filmmaker? I know that's a broad question, but do you have your idiosyncrasies, how you like, I know you're very much hands-on with the camera.
Yes.
Talk to us about your style.
Well, I think that the thing that throws off people the most, especially other American filmmakers,
mm-hmm.
is that I do not work with a script.
Ah, okay.
Because having a script will mean that I know what you're going to say. Or that I will steer you towards saying what I want to say to suit my script.
Uh-huh.
And my premise is I want to challenge what I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up to do the investigation, meaning the development of the film as the film evolved. This is an old Italian tradition called the dynamic script.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And neorealismo, the neorealist, the new cinema that came after the war in Italy in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
made almost an art out of this idea of dynamic script. There mm-hmm. was no script. It just went out and you shoot, even in fiction. I have made so far, I believe, close to 80 documentaries.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I've never shot with a script a documentary. I shot fiction with a script, but I never had a script prior to shooting the documentary. And this has created a lot of problems and a lot of advantages. The problem is, how are you going to raise the money if you don't have a script?
Yes. It was good to ask you that.
Well, at the beginning it's harder, but after you have 60 documentaries, people begin to trust you and, you know, relationships built and, you know, on from there. Other advantages is that you do get to challenge your views.
Yes.
Let's say that I go with a camera today to Tehran.
Uh-huh.
because I want to film the reality of Iranians in their own land.
Mm-hmm.
If I have a script, that script will be based on what we know here. So why am I going in there if I already know what's going on?
Yes, exactly.
So I will bring my camera and start interviewing people, and the script is going to come out of that experience. So in a sense, I'll bring you with me along.
Yes. Yes. I hear that. Yes. So, and besides, not to put too political a point on it, but still, we don't know what's going on. Especially, I often write, Americans really don't understand the Middle East. There's a lot we don't understand, but the Middle East is very up top of the list. And to go there with a camera and let the people speak for themselves. There was a moment like that in the news the other night in ABC News, reporter with a North Korean lady and asking her how she felt about things. And I loved it. She was telling what they're told and so forth. And then he said he was an American. And she said, oh, I didn't realize you were American. You're very nice. That's not what we're told over here. So it works both ways, but you know. And she was very, you know, very, she wasn't overly, she didn't apologize at all. She just explained he was different from what she's been told. So you're right. You take the camera and let the people speak for themselves. And you, even with Monroe Hill, you get a truth that at the very least has been ignored, if not intentionally buried for who knows.
And one more thing I'd like to add about Monroe Hill is not only about the farm on the map, it's about the human factor, about the people who inhabited it. And I'm referring not only to James Monroe, his uncle James Jones, his brother Joseph, and his other brother Andrew, and Madison that came over and stayed and said night there.
Yes.
But about the nearly 20 enslaved men and women that we know of.
Yes.
And the women that we don't know of and the children that we don't know of because they were not property, taxable property. So they're not in the property taxes. So we don't know how many of those were there. And we don't know how many more were hired from other farms like the Dawson farm or any other farm during the harvest. So we did learn about Phinia Hemmings, Sally Hemmings, sister, who was at Monroe Hill and died at Monroe Hill in 1796. And that is a very interesting story, but in order to find out more about Sally Hemmings' older sister, her five children, and her partner, Peter, you will have to see the film.
Yes, which is Monroe
I'm
Hill.
Tell you everything.
And that film would be Monroe Hill. That is its premiere at the Virginia Film Festival.
It premieres at the Virginia Film Festival on Friday, November 6th at 5 p.m. at the Newcomb Hall.
Very good, Beacon Hall. Excellent. Yeah. Well, I have to say, Eduardo, this has been just a marvelous conversation. I'm so happy we ran into each other a second time so that I could ask you to be on the show. And we've sort of come, with your last comment, we've sort of come full circle because we started out discussing how we met at the University of Virginia's forum symposium on the university's histories with slavery. And here you are filling in the blank still with Monroe Hill, that things we thought we knew. Any parting words for us before we have to go filmatically?
After listening to your voice for about 45 minutes, I definitely need to use your voice in my next adventure.
Well, I'd love to work with you. You know that. It's just, I'm looking forward to that truly because I've seen your work, and of course I know you by reputation, and we've met twice, not counting this conversation today, and all those conversations have inspired me that there's a lot of simpatico, a lot of passion in common. And but anyway, we must run. Our guest today has been documentary maker Eduardo Montes Bradley. I love that name. And he is now living in Charlottesville, Virginia, creating great on-camera work at the University of Virginia with University of Virginia students as well. And I, one thing I didn't ask you, how long have you lived in Charlottesville?
We've been here for 5 years.
Ah, okay. All right, because I think I'm going into my seventh year now. So we've definitely, it's time for us to work together. Okay.
Absolutely. Looking forward to meeting you again and having some coffee and talking more.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Eduardo, and all the best in all you do, but especially for Monroe Hill and the Virginia Film Festival. Okay?
Thank you.
Take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Stay with us as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. An accomplished movie star has advantages when he decides to make his first film. In the case of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's Don John, it allowed him to cast Scarlett Johansson, Julianne Moore, and, well, himself. Fair warning, dealing as it does with the subject of addiction to internet porn, Don John is exceedingly risque. Those easily offended by comedic explorations of sex might want to steer clear. Nonetheless, it will serve as a catalyst for some mighty interesting conversations. Levitt plays Don, a Brooklyn Lothario who would never be caught with less than a 10. But when it comes right down to it, all those 10s aren't so special. None can live up to the fantasy available online. But then he meets Johansson's character, a 10+. She plays her own game, and a controlling one at that. So maybe it's time to settle down. Then again, well, he's got this internet problem. Don John is a surprisingly confident first film. Kudos for bringing a touchy subject to light for exploration, and even better for exploring it with such abundantly entertaining, often squirm-worthy humor. Don John. Not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. It's about the first woman to chair. When the starting gate for minorities and goalposts for women are relics of second-class citizenship, the question isn't who's on first, but are we still defining exceptionalism with the 1790 Naturalization Act, which excluded American Indians, indentured servants, slaves, free blacks, and Asians from American citizenship? Or are we just electing chair covers who prefer the 1870 Naturalization Act, which did admit to the possibility of Black Lives Matter, but still not other alien immigrants, and no legal status given non-white women? It's all about that. It's about the race not always going to the swift, but the slick. Is it about candidates unable to give us the simplicity of black and white solutions, or that conflicts of interest are born when corporate wealth culls the middle class? Is it just about being first, when first is about job title, income, neighborhood, family structure, or spouse? No, it's about testing, where poverty starts and mass incarceration ends. Is Congress about declaring the United States wants only citizens who can care for themselves without the assistance of others, thus denying American citizenship to the uneducated, mentally ill, and poor? Or is it about race and nationality discrimination being ensconced in American law in 1898, still thriving and flourishing in 2016 conservative politics? Are we still about Immigration and Naturalization Service officials using the 1911 Dictionary of Races or Peoples to determine a person's qualifications to immigrate to the land of the free? If so, it's about non-white women need not apply. Is it about the dots connecting our 1920s Supreme Court upholding a national racist immigration policy and our 2010 Citizens United Supremes selling out our electoral process? Isn't it about time Congress and the laws of the land reject the neglect of equal citizenship for the female half of our population, instead of holding fast to laws set in 1700 stone, restricting gender equality for women of every hue and a decent minimum wage for all Americans? Is it about fearing equal economic opportunity, equal pay for equal work, equal credit opportunities, equal health care services and maternity leave, or about honoring all the first women to chair by ratifying the Equal Rights Amendment? It's about American Revolutionary War veteran Mary Ludwig Hayes, American Red Cross founder Carla Barton, English Channel flyer Harriet Quimby, and orchestral conductor Mary Davenport Engberg. It's about peace-loving Congresswoman Jeanette Rankin, whose Vietnam War protests, had they been heeded, could have spared a little Vietnamese girl life-changing napalm burns. It's about that. It's not only Susan Bromwell Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and Lucy Stone, but Alice Paul, who introduced the first Equal Rights Amendment in Congress. It wasn't just Amelia Earhart, but Pacific Ocean Betty Miller, Eileen Collins, and first cabinet chair Frances Perkins. It's about the Seventh Vail Oscar winner Muriel Box, first Arizona Senate Majority Leader Sandra Day O'Connor, and Cherokee Chief Wilma Mankiller. It's about all Rosie the Riveters. Poet laureate Mona Jane Van Doon, Janet Reno, Madeleine Albright, Nancy Pelosi, Barbara Boxer, and potential first chair of the land, Hillary Clinton, prove it's about diplomacy, the artistic edge, and justice for all. It's about excellence over exceptionalism, like What's My Line, Arlene Francis, Barbara Streisand, Catherine Bigelow, the Lionesses of Broadway, Julie Taymor, Lisa Crone, and Janine Tesori. And it's about Cuba to Florida swimmer Diana Niad. It's not about Brandi Chatzin's shirt, but the U.S. women's soccer team at the White House, because equal achievement should equal equal citizenship. And it's about my childhood crushes, Maureen O'Hara and Annette Funicello. It's about my friendship with Mercedes McCambridge. It's about Patrick Hayes introducing me to Zelda Fitchlander back when divorced women lost the use of their credit cards and their credit standing, which they had shared with their husbands when married. Finally, it's about all those we've called the help. Hattie McDaniel, Aretha Franklin, Felicia Rashad, Audra McDonald, Oprah Winfrey, the uncaged inaugural poet Maya Angelou, the incomparable Viola Davis, and the resource officer assaulted Spring Valley High School girl. Yes, it's about that too. It's about legally acknowledging the equality of all mothers, daughters, wives, sisters, aunts, and girlfriends, because it's about time. It's about them. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.